Folks, why don't we get started? Good evening. My name is Carton Rogers. I'm the Vice Provost and Director of Libraries here at the University of Pennsylvania. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to the 2009 ASW Rosenbach Lectures in Bibliography. Before I forget it, and I always do, we do have a book at the back of the room, a sign-up book, and if you would be so kind as just tell us that you were here. We promise we won't turn that information over to the government or anything like that, so, but we might turn it over to our development office, which may be just as onerous. This year's lecture series, entitled The Evangelical Public Sphere, begins this evening and will continue on Wednesday night at 5:30 and conclude on Thursday evening, also at 5:30, and both of those lectures will also be here in the Rosenwald Gallery. Tonight's lecture will be followed by a very elaborate and extraordinary reception. So I've been told, anyway. I invite you all to stay after the after tonight's lecture, have some food, enjoy the conversation, and also take a look at this really wonderful exhibit that surrounds us on the floor. It's called "Did Censorship Make the French Enlightenment?" I'd like to take this opportunity to thank my colleagues in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library, Andrea Gottschalk, Lynn Farrington, John Pollock, Dan Traster, and David McKnight, Amy Hutchins, Nancy Shawcross, and everybody else on the floor who was involved in making this year's lectures come off. There's a lot of planning and logistical work that goes into it. And I'm very, very appreciative of the efforts of this staff to keep these lecture series going. I'd also like to point out that we have a wonderful events coordinator, Alita Arthurs, and she's the one you can thank for the food you get tonight. But she's been a wonderful addition to the staff. I always like to take advantage of the opportunity on opening night to do a quick history of this event. For those of you who are here for the first time and think that we are trying out something new, the Rosenbach Lectures actually enjoy a long and honored tradition. In 1928, ASW Rosenbach, the great American bookseller, donated $20,000 to the university to establish a fellowship in bibliography. Dr. Rosenbach's Philadelphia-based antiquarian bookselling firm dominated the rare book trade during a significant portion of the early 20th century. And he himself was the author of many standard reference books and bibliographical studies. He also wrote a number of really interesting books about book collecting. In his letter of November 12, 1928, to then-provost Josiah Penniman, agreeing to create what we refer to today as an endowment fund, Dr. Rosenbach noted that the increasing interest in bibliography warrants such an appointment, and I believe it would be also of material advantage to the library of the university and all other libraries of the city if an honorary fellowship in bibliography were established. The fellowship quickly morphed into an annual lecture, with the first fellow slash lecturer being Christopher Morley in 1931. Morley himself had this to say about the man who endowed these lectures. I'm quoting now from Christopher Morley. "Perhaps it was because Dr. Rosenbach was born in Philadelphia in its great romantic year, the year of its centennial in 76. That's 1876 for the younger members of the audience here, not the bicentennial in 1976, that he was endowed with his miracle of book instinct. He is a willow wand for the hidden springs of book lore. He is the Pied Piper of rare editions. He blows an airy wheedling note, and the old vellums and calfskins come trotting after him. They disappear into his twin Venusbergs on Walnut Street and on Madison Avenue. And if he happens to take a fancy to keep them himself, they are never heard from again. There is no one in the world rich enough to buy from Rosie anything that he thinks belongs on his private shelves." Since Morley in 1931, distinguished scholars had delivered lectures on a vast range of bibliographic topics, including 15th century printing, early American papermaking, the 18th century reading public, and the history of American rare book libraries. If you remember, if you were here last year, the topic was the Latin Bible as Codex. We've been really blessed to have a relationship with the University Press, and most, not quite all, but most of the lectures have actually been published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, and we certainly hope that that will continue. And I'm pleased to have that relationship and very thankful of the efforts of Eric Halpert and Jerry Singerman to make that all happen. So with that background, let's forge ahead. I have the pleasure of introducing someone who then will introduce tonight's speaker. I'm introducing David Hall, who is also a past presenter. 2 years ago, David? Yeah. David Hall is the Bartlett Research Professor of New England Church History at the Harvard Divinity School. David has taught at HDS since 1989 and was the Bartlett Professor of New England Church History until 2008, when he became the Bartlett Research Professor. He writes extensively on religion and society in 17th century New England and England. His books include The Faithful Shepherd, A History of the New England Ministry in the 17th Century, Worlds of Wonder, Days of Judgment, Popular Religious Belief in Early New England, and Puritans in the New World, a critical anthology. He has edited two key collections of documents, The Antinomian Controversy of 1636 to 1638, a documentary history, and Witch Hunting in 17th Century New England, a documentary history, 1638 to 1693. Another interest of David's is the history of the book, especially the history of literacy and reading in early America. He edited with Hugh Amory the colonial book In the Atlantic World, the first of a five-volume series of which he is the general editor. He continues to study and write about religion and culture in early America with particular attention to lived religion, and is working on the development of cultural criticism in mid-19th century America. In 2007, as I mentioned, David gave the Rosenbach Lectures under the title Pen and Press, Practices of Writing and Publishing in Colonial America. These lectures have appeared under the title Ways of Writing, the Practice and Politics of Textmaking in 17th Century New England, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Please join me in welcoming David Hall.
Let me begin by saying that it's a great pleasure to be back in this room, a pleasure magnified by the fact that I don't have to give the lecture, but a pleasure nonetheless to be here where just a little more than 2 years ago I had such a wonderful time enjoying the hospitality of so many of you here at Penn, an intellectual hospitality as well as a social hospitality. And so again, thank you all for being here tonight, and thanks for your kindnesses to me 2 years ago. This evening is about the present and the future, but my mind has turned back to the past, and so I want to share with you very, very briefly a couple of stories that touch on our speaker of this evening. In 1985, the American Antiquarian Society, having launched a program in the history of the book in America, staged the first of what has now been a continuing series of summer seminars in the history of the book, a one-week seminar. The director of the first was the late Stephen Botine, who invited me to come out and give or lead one of the sessions, and my then interest was on literacy, and so I don't recall any longer what I was using as text, but I do remember extremely vividly an experience that happens to teachers, most of us at one point or another. Namely, I was going on about literacy and I was trying to evoke some discussion from the 20 or 25 people gathered there, and someone began to speak in ways that, in response to my pleas for help, someone began to speak with this kind of lucidity and perspicaciousness that I realized about the second time this person spoke exceeded my own by some distance. I didn't know the people there, that is to say, I had not met the people there before, but afterwards I realized that it was a graduate student or just about to be an ex-graduate student. I guess you were by that point, a just recently minted doctoral student at Johns Hopkins, namely our speaker this evening. So I learned for the first but not the last time that I was in the presence of someone of tremendous acumen. And then there was another experience that I had with someone who I think has not made it to here this evening, Roger Sharty, unless he's in the back. I know he's en route.
He can't make it until Wednesday,
unfortunately. At any rate, but I want to tell this as a parallel story, just about sort of about myself, really. But in 1994, there was a colloque in Paris on the history of reading, and I arranged with Roger, because I was going to speak in English, I arranged with him ahead of time for him to summarize this lecture as I gave it with, I'd given him the English text and we'd marked various places where I would stop and he would then summarize. So this happened, I read for a while and then stopped and Roger summarized, at which point I said in French, "Why continue?" Because the summary was so very much better than what I was saying. I mean, it wasn't just a translation, it wasn't just a reproduction, it carried it to a higher level. And then to connect Roger Sharty, Michael Warner, and myself, you may remember in 1989 we were in Washington at a conference provoked by the French Revolution, the anniversary of the French Revolution, and in some sense the anniversary of our own installation of our new national government. And I gave a paper. Actually, I had left my paper in Los Angeles, so I couldn't give my paper, but I gave a version of a paper. And Michael Warner gave a paper, and Roger said afterwards, "How can we reconcile these two papers?" Well, he isn't here for us to pursue that conversation, and I think the issues are long since behind us. But let me just remind you that Michael Warner now holds the position of Seymour Knox Professor of English and Professor of American Studies at Yale, recently there just his second year, having taught for many, many years at Rutgers and having earned in 1985 his PhD at Johns Hopkins. He's published on quite a few subjects, but I want to linger on the book that has most influenced me and say just a few words about his first book, The Letters of the Republic. Okay, now I've got my handwriting here is not so good. Publication in the Public Sphere in 18th Century America. This book, when it was published by Harvard, caused a kind of shock. It sent a shockwave through the field of early American literature. I recall vividly, as over yesterday, an emeritus colleague of mine, someone in English, American literature, saying to me when he learned that I actually liked the book, and he shook his head. He said, "Oh, this is not a good book. This is bringing theory, at the time when theory with capital T was like a dread disease that you saw coming from afar. This is bringing theory into early American literature. It's going to ruin everything." Actually, this book has been proved to be not only proved to be really the starting point, the provocation, as all really good books are, the provocation for many other works, truly an original work. What was original about it? Let me just mention two things. One is that Michael took the term print, as in printing or printed or print culture, took the term print and taught us, ensured that we did not understand it as a naturalized term, that its meaning shifts with cultural and political and social situations. And this is beautifully, beautifully worked out, in particular in a transition from what he refers to as the personality of print under certain religious circumstances, which may in fact come back here, I'm imagining it'll come back here today, and the impersonality of print in the 18th century. Secondly, he took the term public sphere, which did not yet have the currency then that it has now among us. And he tried to, or attempted to, strip that term of any necessary connection to cultural or political liberalism, as though print itself always has to be seen as ever more democratic, ever more promoting a liberal society. And there are many other features of the book, but I just want to say that it remains to this day a powerfully, powerfully provocative book. And if you haven't yet encountered it, and it's not a book that's for which the provocations are limited to the field of early American literature, I urge you to go to it or to return to it. It is worth returning to. Michael Warner tells us in a piece that's posted on his website, a short piece posted on his website, that as a child and youthful person, he listened to a great many sermons. This is something else you and I have in common, although I don't think I listened to quite as many as you did, but just as forced. And it may be that there's an image of me at the age of five, holding a hymn book upside down, since I don't know how to read it, sitting piously in the front row of a small church gathering. So Michael Warner tells us in his autobiographical piece that what he has learned from religion, from his own upbringing in Pentecostalism, has advanced him intellectually, but it was also something he had to unlearn, and the unlearning has also advanced him. And I can imagine in advance of what he's going to speak this evening that as he lectures on printing and preaching, what is a sermon, he will both learn us and unlearn us. Let us welcome Michael Warner.
Why continue? Especially gives me trepidation to give this talk with David in the audience, since on almost every paragraph he knows more about the subject than I do. But I'm sure he'll tell me all about that afterwards. Let me thank John Pollock and David and Jerry for putting this together. I'm very appreciative for this lovely invitation and this opportunity to run this material by you. Let me say just a word at the beginning about the series as a series, because I have put these together in contemplation of a book, and the book will be somewhat longer than I can contain within the series. So I want to give you just the outline so that you'll know a little bit about what you're not hearing, even if you are so hardy or foolhardy as to come to all three lectures. This first lecture is condensed between the introduction and the first chapter, and I hope will serve as an introduction to the issues, although it is a bit hasty in some areas. And there will be on Wednesday, a chapter about Edwards and Franklin that I've called Between Free Thought and Evangelicalism. Thursday's lecture, the title has been changed from the original publicity, and for this I apologize to the organizers for changing my mind so late in the process, but it will in fact be called The Evangelical Black Atlantic, Wheatley and Morant. It'll be about Phyllis Wheatley and John Morant. So the remaining two lectures in the series are going to be a series of case studies, and obviously the common denominator between Jonathan Edwards, Benjamin Franklin, Phyllis Wheatley, and John Morant is George Whitefield. But I'm not giving you a couple of other chapters, and let me just describe to you briefly what they do. One is about the transformation of the term religion in the 18th century, and the growing idea of belief as a defining criterion of religion, and the relation between that history and various printed genres, including ethnographies. And the last chapter will be about some of the public sphere controversies of the 1790s. It will be called The Discursive Public as the Object of Religious Struggle, or at least that's my working title. Okay, but now for what is a sermon. The Savior's Invitation, published by the American Tract Society in 1828, illustrates the degree to which evangelicals had by that point mastered the techniques of mass publicity. It also shows how the techniques of mass publicity had mastered the evangelicals. Salvation is here presented as a universal offer, impersonally advanced to a reader who is particularized in no way except as a reader of English. Perhaps it was thrust into one's hands on the street, or perhaps it was left on your chair as you came in. Maybe you sat on it and made an ugly crumpling noise. One implication of its printedness, its form, and its distribution is that a considerable randomization has entered in between the author and the reader. The text even addresses the reader with questions, art thou mourning, art thou destitute, and so on, giving us a menu of particularities for different possible readers, implying both that this series could be extended indefinitely and that if it were, it would be sure to cover your own case. The address is both impersonal and personal in a way that makes salient at some level of consciousness the randomness of the appeal. That is, you have to, in order to process the prose, you have to think about all the people it's addressing who aren't you. This randomization of the reader is important because the uttering agent of the text, the speaker, as new critics would say, is also curiously vague. It is perhaps corporate, since the society itself is identified at the bottom as the publisher. But at any rate, it is both impersonally footed and existentially urgent. The opening line is a quotation, attributed, of course, to Jesus, but this sets the stage for a more mysterious attribution of the flyer's language in general to Jesus. He it is who now speaks to thee. In order to make sense of this double voicing, that is, it's both an impersonal, possibly corporate voice that can quote Jesus and a voice that can tell you that it is Jesus. We understand that the text is projecting an ideal situation in which the reading of the text, although by anyone, anywhere, grounded in no other context or relationship, affects conversion. We might, of course, already be converted, in which case we recognize that it is not quite for us, but we still understand imaginatively that the right uptake of the text is a conversionist reading, that is, a reading in which conversion begins. With that in mind, the obscurity of the speaker allows us to imagine that it might indeed be a vehicle for a spirit-guided address. Hence the title, which plays on the fact that the handbill is the size and form of a printed invitation. As the Savior's invitation, in quotation marks, it is anonymous, corporate, public, and physical, but it is also understood to be the vehicle of a personal, private, and spiritual invitation. What's more, the breadth of the address, the randomization of the reader, and the corporate agency of distribution combine to make it likely that the vast majority of its actual readers are not its avowed target. The American Tract Society distributed in mass in hopes of converting a margin. So the conversionist uptake in the pamphlet is, in the ordinary case, a kind of imitation of conversionist uptake. One might almost say a performing theater of conversion, in which the converted read by imagining the converting force that this language might have for the unconverted. To read it is to imagine a conversion happening somewhere, perhaps now. Evangelical discourse of this kind is a perpetual reconversion machine or reaffirmation machine. Moreover, this secondary derivative conversion can have a normative cast. Witnessing the conversion of someone somewhere now, which we witness insofar as we have imagined it as the ideal scene of uptake, we can feel that we are participants in the effort to convert the masses. Thus, the notionally primary scene of conversionist reading can be intimately linked to a chain of conversion. To be converted is to wish for and assist the conversion of others, and the rhetoric of the handbill fuses these two with great economy. In this fusion between conversion and the modern imagination of print publics as formed by uptake, evangelicalism found a powerful rhetoric. By the time of the Tract Society's heyday, American evangelicals had learned to represent their form of religiosity as ideally expressive of the voluntary system, i.e., disestablished denominationalism. But the resulting version of Christianity, in which conversionistic address to strangers became the privileged instance of religiosity, was in tension with other versions of Christianity, those more centered on communities of worship and ritual practice especially. And notice that although the handbill does address a wide variety of people, it addresses them as though they have no previous religion. So, art thou mourning, but not art thou a Roman Catholic or anything else. The implied theology of conversion, in addition, is directly contrary to the Reformed vision with which evangelicalism began. If you're familiar with Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, for example, you might remember how often Edwards reminds his hearers that this is that God is under no obligation to offer salvation to the hearers. Modern evangelicalism and the public sphere are two dimensions, I think, of the same media culture. By the early 19th century, evangelicals themselves could make the connection explicit. The American Tract Society announced its reorganization in 1825 with a letter to the Christian public, which goes as follows. So long as public opinion maintains its existing supremacy, who does not feel the importance, the immense importance of molding it by a moral and religious influence, and of securing and augmenting our civil and political liberties by the most unconfined diffusion of the light of science and religion throughout a community whose political existence depends on the intelligence and more especially on the integrity of the people, unquote. With the American Tract Society and other ventures like it, the norms of this passage informed an impressive array of publication techniques, as has been emphasized by such historians as David Nord, Candy Brown, and John Lardis Modern. One might be surprised at this close relation. Neither Habermas's Structural Transformation nor my own Letters of the Republic paid any attention to evangelicalism at all. We seem to have taken it for granted that religion was a separate matter. So do these recent critics who have tried to focus attention on evangelicalism by explaining it as a reaction against the so-called secular rationalist enlightenment, or those who say that to study the public sphere is to overemphasize print in an age of popular orality. In these lectures, I'll try to set aside all of these grand oppositions. In the 18th century, new ways of addressing strangers and new ways of imagining the field of circulation lay behind both the public sphere and evangelicalism, and these forms can be found in print, manuscript, and oral delivery alike. The Savior's invitation is not a sermon, but it is a kind of preaching. In its conception of religion and its social imaginary, it reveals much about the assumptions of stranger sociability that also underlie the practices of circuit riding and the system of denominationalism. The evangelicalism of the Tract Society was a far cry from what earlier Anglo-American Protestants had understood by the evangelical religion. To those of Edwards's generation, this was a distinct tradition of literate devotion, stressing solicitude over the subjective and affective life of piety, and coupled with an experimental concern with conversion. By experimental, in this context, people meant both the necessity of firsthand experience of conversion and an analysis of the forms and characteristics of conversion experience based on wide pastoral observation. Conversion experience was understood broadly as happening over long stretches of time, and was attentive to methods of preparation as well as inferences of sanctification. Various uses of print were essential to this culture from the beginning, as is well known, and among them are conversionistic appeals such as Baxter's Call, which is also reprinted in the 19th century by the American Tract Society. So you might think that there is just a long, unbroken continuity here, which in some ways there is. I put up the 1658 edition on the left, because I'm interested in the way the opening declaration to the reader picks up on some of the themes of today's lecture, to all unsanctified persons that shall read this book. But notice that he immediately goes on to qualify this as though he has ambivalence about a printed book, so as to say, especially of my hearers in the borough and parish of Kidderminster. On the right, you'll see the Algonquin translation, 1688. I have no idea how, in fact, they have translated such a specific conception of speaking, but there it is. Christian universalism is here tempered by a doctrine of election by the Calvinist scheme of conversion and by the conventions of clerical speech in Reformed ecclesiology, all of which mitigate against the placeless universal address of the Savior's invitation. Anglo-Americans who came in contact with European or other immigrant versions of pietism sometimes shared its impulses of mysticism and quietism. But the version of evangelicalism they had created by the late 18th century was neither mystical nor quietist. It is remarkable instead for its aggressive expansionism, its tendency to see translocal and public affinities as primary over local and parochial communities of worship and pastoral care, the universalist orientation of its practices, which, as contemporaries pointed out, was often in conflict with its more Calvinist theology, a genre of revivalism with its highly genericized collective rituals paradoxically made possible only by seeing them as occasions for spontaneous private conversion, a recontextualized idea of conversion that was immediately knowable and felt rather than inferred through sanctification, moralized public activism, and so on. Evangelicalism in this latter sense is a distinctly modern form of religiosity, modern both in its social imaginary and in its semiotic ideology. Its expansiveness at home, a kind of domestic missionization, mirrored its expansiveness abroad in colonial missionization. This is a part of the series that I'm truncating drastically, so let me just show you briefly a little bit of a polemical passage which I'm omitting here. This is I'm trying to understand evangelicalism not by the doctrinal emphasis, which has so far dominated the intellectual history of evangelicalism, since all of these doctrinal elements could be found almost anywhere, anytime, and surely evangelicalism is not just the sum of people who believe these things. Instead, I'm moving toward an approach more like this. And again, I'm sorry that I'm not going to go into this in more detail, but I think you can grasp the idea. In these lectures, I will concentrate specifically on the discourse culture of evangelicalism. Why the discourse culture of evangelicalism? Well, it would be somewhat distorting to compare the beliefs or the doctrinal content of, say, evangelicals, Quakers, and freethinkers, since in each of these traditions, the relation between persons and religious discourse is differently structured, with the practices of discourse, speaking, praying, theorizing, preaching, reading, singing, and so on, carrying different ethical burdens and working in different ways to organize the space through which discourse moves. So, at one extreme, Edward Deering once defined the church itself as a company called together by the voice of a preacher, which, if it were standing alone, would theoretically reduce all ecclesiology to the situation of address established by preaching, meaning that that sermon audition was a ritual practice with a significance far from accounted for by the content of the sermon. Deistical free thought, at the other extreme, has no comparable discursive ritual. And although I believe, as will become clear on Wednesday, that the aspiration to religiosity in free thought needs to be taken seriously, the religious practice of deism might be said to consist primarily in the printing and reading of theological argument. Earlier, I quoted a passage by the American Tract Society celebrating the unconfined diffusion of science and religion. This is a spatial image of the field of circulation, understood as a kind of broadcasting, diffusing, expanding through time in an empty space. The space in which diffusion occurs is understood, in that example at least, through a telos of saturated space, so that you would end with the uniformity of a Christian public. But it is also understood as not yet that. Implicitly, it is the scene of a struggle performed in the utterance of the speech itself. It is driven in the urgency of its diffusion by a sharp sense of social division between the converted and the unconverted, between the agents of benevolence and the objects of benevolence, the subjects of moral discipline, and the surrounding world of sinful indulgence, which in turn is imagined as a theater in which the emergent examples of conversion and discipline will be admired and emulated. There's a strong sense in the Savior's invitation of a kind of miraculous agency to this diffusion, but at the same time, there is an underlying conception of the social as a secular space of normatively expanded and unimpeded circulation. So, what effect does such a conception have on forms of religiosity? What is the difference between Christians gathered as a church and Christians addressed as a public? And if the public is already Christian, why does it need to be evangelized? Surely this tension is one reason why so many readers, Christian and otherwise, feel discomfort with this kind of discourse. This sense of the space of public speech as an empty space waiting for the diffusion of the gospel also conflicts with another conception of public speech, not as socially horizontal, open, and neutral, but rather as intrinsically laden with the organizing hierarchies of the social. Recent analyses by Talal Assad and others of blasphemy, the Danish cartoon controversy, and the French affairs of the veil have emphasized this fundamental conflict over different conceptions of the ethics of public speech. In many of these critiques, the Western model, the free speech model, the idea of public space, public discourse as an empty space waiting to be filled with private expression, is referred to as liberalism. In these lectures, I want to suggest that this meta-discursive conception developed in different quarters and for different reasons. This basic orientation to the public has different inflections in evangelicalism and free thought, but there is an underlying conception common to both. That is obviously the subject of Wednesday's lecture. But the underlying structure is not just print. 30 years ago, Harry Stout published what proved to be an influential essay on the political importance of evangelicalism. Titled Religion, Communications, and the Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, it examined claims of a causal relation between the evangelical revivals of the 18th century and the revolution. Stout thought that although no direct continuity could be shown in conceptual vocabulary or ideas, nevertheless, there was an important connection in the social history of language. His argument rested on two main claims, one about strangers and one about orality. First, he observed that before the revivals, there were few contexts, if any, in which colonists met each other regularly as strangers in a framework of voluntary association. The revivals, therefore, helped to erode norms of localism and forge a new kind of mass awareness. Second, he urged that they did this not by means of print wars and political pamphlets. The essay was published right after Bernard Bailyn's Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, and the title was meant to be a kind of counterpost, but by moving beyond the restrictive literacy of elite typographical culture, his phrase. Evangelical preachers, he thought, appealed to the common sort in the demotic voice of popular orality. Unlike print, this is Stout, unlike print, which is essentially passive, reflective, and learned, sound is active, immediate, and spontaneously compelling in its demand for a response. Thus, the preachers reached the people in a way that the pamphleteers never could and created a leveling form of address with what Stout took to be obviously democratic implications. Now, I want to agree with the first of Stout's theses and disagree with the second one. The point about strangers is, I think, absolutely central. This way of being normatively related to strangers is one of the most striking things about the evangelical public sphere. We are entirely accustomed to such things in our mediatic society. In the 18th century, such environments came into being only as the result of both creativity and stress. But we can only properly understand this by abandoning the contrast between print and orality. This is another polemic that I'm cutting out for the sake of brevity, but let me just say a word about it, because it is, I think, a problem in a lot of recent scholarship. When orality became a technical term in scholarship through the work of Walter Ong and others, there was an attempt to be fairly rigorous in distinguishing between primary orality, which is societies that have no writing, and secondary orality, which is the way of being of people in literate societies who are not themselves literate. But in a lot of contemporary scholarship, the word orality has taken on a third sense, which I think has no justification whatsoever, which is just the mode of discourse of all spoken environments. That is to say, there's a kind of metaphysical premise when people use the word orality to describe societies that are already saturated by script and highly structured by script practices. There's a metaphysical premise that all instances of speech have something meaningful in common. I think that that's without foundation and unexamined. And when you're talking about a society like 18th century America, there is no such thing as orality. There is no thing that you can point to as constant across all conditions of speech. But that, as I say, I'm cutting that out. Since Stout's influential essay, Frank Lambert has published an exactly contrary interpretation of the meaning of the revivals of the middle of the 18th century. In his view, they were the direct result of new print-based modes of organization. Lambert's 1999 book, Inventing the Great Awakening, gives us ample evidence for seeing the revivals as essentially a restructuring of pietistic impulses in North Atlantic Protestantism by means of modern media culture. Whitfield, he reminds us, employed advanced publicity agents who promoted his tours through advertisements, circular letters, and stories planted in local newspapers. To an unprecedented degree, he published his own sermons, journals, and letters. He orchestrated controversy, making sure that his tours would become media events of a familiarly modern sort. And between 1737 and 1745, more than 300 Whitfield imprints were issued in such numbers as to represent one publication for every 20 people in Britain and the colonies combined. Oops, how did I get there? I'm holding it upside down, that's why. There we go. Note the publisher, and also note the title of the last sermon, which I'll come back to. in addition, Lambert shows that the revivals themselves quickly became genericized. And this is a circular letter soliciting narratives of the revivals. And as other scholars pointed out, strategies of revivalism worked in part because the transatlantic world of evangelicals was already knit together in a web of correspondence and printed exchange. Now, obviously, it is not very helpful to explain mid-18th century revivalism one moment as a burst of orality and the next moment as the intrusion of print. Both readings pick up on important features of evangelicalism, but both quickly lead to misconceptions insofar as they are rooted in the assumption that orality and print are separate, exclusive media environments. In a movement context that mixes printed and preached sermons with pamphlets and newspapers, performance and print were densely laminated together. Preaching throughout the colonial period in those colonies of the Reformed tradition was neither print nor orality. It was a set of complex intermedial relations, a circuit of simultaneous phases that included reading, commonplacing, collecting, indexing, composing, source noting, schematizing, memorizing, reading, reciting, performances of ethical hearing, note-taking, meditation, manuscript circulation, print circulation, pious reading, correspondence, exchange, indifference, distraction, and so on. Before the Revolution, practices of sermon circulation varied sharply from region to region. Vastly more sermons were printed in New England. As one traveled south, printed sermons became not only rarer, but were a much smaller percentage of the overall output of the press. Eventually, evangelicalism did much to create a common trans-regional preaching culture. And in the 19th century, there is much evidence of a trans-confessional impact of the evangelical model, that is to say, Catholics and Jews imitating Protestant preaching styles. In the early period of evangelicalism, however, it was the print-heavy North that was formative of the evangelical style, which is now more associated with the demotic oral preaching of the South. How exactly did sermons circulate in New England, and how did this come about? Many sermons were printed, far more than any other category of imprints other than government documents, but hardly any were published in the modern sense of an edition capitalized at the publisher's risk with the expectation of gain on returns from the market. In fact, to a remarkable degree, the world of sermonic print circulation in the early 18th century was buffered against publication in this sense. This is something that's known to specialists in the field. It's certainly there in the pages of the Amory and Hall book and in an essay by Rollo Silver that's now half century old. But I don't think that the full impact of the non-capitalist character of 18th century sermon publication has yet sunk in. many imprints of occasional sermons. Occasional sermons are those that are printed for ritual occasions like elections, and probably constitute over 3/4 of the total printed sermons. Many imprints of occasional sermons were printed on corporate commission. Most election and artillery sermons were published by the bodies for which they were preached. Some were printed by subscription, others by public, directly from public funds. In the case of Samuel Mather's 1739 artillery sermon, "War is lawful and arms are to be proved, the company arranged both the pay and the distribution of the pay for the printer and the distribution of the copies, one for the governor and every member of the General Assembly, two for every member of the company. Distribution to strangers does not seem to have been contemplated, except as possibly a way to dispose of that extra copy that every company member was given. Funeral sermons tended to be either subscribed or subsidized by a family member. Recently deceased pastors were sometimes commemorated by the publication of one of their sermons at the congregation's expense. Ordination sermons, likewise, were often printed by the churches as a kind of ceremonial event. Indeed, in all of these examples, which taken together constitute the vast majority of colonial printed sermons, the temporal import of printing tends to be commemorative of preaching rather than anticipatory of further circulation. Churches could sometimes print sermons just because they were particularly impressed by them. A monitor for delaying sinners, for example, was evidently preached to an audience that was fond of recirculating sermon notes, as the preface by Increase Mather tells us. "I rejoice to hear that in Bradford there is a number of young men who meet together on the evening of the Lord's Day to pray and repeat sermons and sing psalms." Notice the phrase "repeat sermons." Their pastor preached this sermon to encourage them, and his auditors were so affected with it as to importune him to grant them a copy of his discourse in order to its publication by the press. In a culture where it was common for sermon goers to practice various kinds of sermon notation, short line, outline, or heads, this kind of printing must have been like a shortcut to the circulation of notes. Mather continues that the reason for printing is that so it might remain with them and others also be edified with it. The others, apparently, are an afterthought. Sermons could also be printed at a preacher's expense for his own distribution. But if preachers had thoughts of reaching a market public, such thoughts must have been counteracted by other concerns more weighty. Cotton Mather repeatedly bought his own sermons off the hands of the bookseller in order to give them away. There were some exceptions. Interestingly, they occur most where sermons had the currency of news or controversy. In 1717, Cotton Mather published an execution sermon called "The Valley of Hinnom," delivered just before the execution of Jeremiah Fenwick, who had murdered his neighbor. "I gave to my bookseller the essay upon the Valley of Hinnom," Mather wrote in his diary. "I was desirous at the same time to have had him take another discourse for the cure of ungoverned anger. He declined it, and I was easy. My discourse must lie under a sentence of death. My labor be buried." But in 5 days' time, the bookseller sells off an impression of near 1,000, which he printed of the former essay, and now he comes to me for the latter. I think one of the things this tells us is that editions of 1,000 are only there for instances where sermons look like news, and also that ministers are ambivalent about publishing to audiences of 1,000. Sermons on earthquakes or other public events were also sometimes printed at the bookseller's expense. Benjamin Franklin printed sermons in all of these modes. In 1732, for example, he printed an ordination sermon by David Evans, published at the request of some of the auditory, and his account books show that the cost of all 400 copies was paid by the minister whose ordination it was. In other words, printing of sermons in these contexts would be more like printing a diploma. That is, it's a kind of ceremonial marker of a public occasion. But in the same year, Franklin printed a sermon speculatively. It was an anti-clerical sermon by William Bowman that had already seen 6 London editions and 1 in Dublin, and had been refuted, versified, abstracted, and parodied all within the same year. With the exception of his Whitfield printing, about which more on Wednesday, Franklin mainly printed sermons only when commissioned to do so by local bodies or ministers who themselves took care, for the most part, of the distribution. Printers who tried to capitalize on a sermon market without some connection to controversy or news usually failed. Isaiah Thomas mocked Timothy Green on this score. It has been said of him, he wrote, that whenever he heard a sermon which he highly approved, he would solicit a copy from the author and print it for his own sales. This honest zeal in the cause of religion often proved injurious to his interest. Large quantities of these sermons lay on hand as dead stock, and after his decease, they were put into baskets, appraised by the bushel, and sold under the value of common waste paper. Very few colonial preachers had their sermons collected outside of thematically specific sermon series. A few rare examples are Samuel Davies, for example. And not until the end of the 18th century do we find sermons anthologized or collected as a genre in compilations, in compilations such as The American Preacher or The Columbian Preacher. This is a kind of interesting example, which I won't have time to talk much about. It's got a interesting prospectus and a solicitation letter. You can see that the manuscripts of these sermons were solicited as a kind of inducement to subscribe to the collection. So a sort of Ponzi scheme of publication. and once this happened, literary imitation soon followed. This is Joseph Denny. I'll say more about the problem of a literary sermon in just a moment. Given this picture of 18th century sermon publication, how were copies distributed once they were printed? Here I wish there were more scholarship available. Some sermons could be found for sale in bookseller shops, obviously, but what percentage of print runs were marketed? And how far afield were they typically for sale? We do know that a great many of the copies must have been distributed gratis among churches and corporate bodies, and another sizable chunk seems to have been exchanged along ministerial correspondence networks. Probably the percentage of printed sermons that ever lay on a shop for sale was very small. Now, here is what I take to be an interesting implication of this peculiar culture of extra-capitalist sermon publication. The printed sermon, in most cases, was not produced in a way that made the competitive solicitation of readers a salient goal of its composition or of its printing. But this is exactly what we see in both the Tract Society text with which I began and in the evangelical mode of preaching as it was practiced by the 19th century. How did this come about? I believe that important shifts in the conception of the sermon and its audience were underway from the beginning of the revivals, which occurred at the same time as, and in complex interplay with, the public sphere styles of print that I analyzed in the Letters to the Republic. Again, some of this has to wait for Wednesday, but some tension between local and translocal modes of circulation is manifest in the form of the Puritan sermon itself. And I noticed that I got my slide out of order, so let me go back here. In the division between doctrine and application sections, this example is from Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. It's not always called application. Sometimes it's called use or a number or dehortation. Is that right? But it's always marked in the printed versions. This formal shift occurring usually halfway or three quarters of the way during the standard Puritan sermon marked the moment at which abstract doctrinal discourse was shown to be grounded in the pastoral address to a congregation. The doctrinal discourse sometimes circulated on its own. Many of the major colonial Puritan treatises were composed and preached as sermon series, but were then published as a string of doctrine sections without applications. Edwards's work of redemption is one of the last great examples of this practice, which had been common for earlier generations as well. In fact, most of the late 17th century theological treatises were composed in this way. Sermons in this world were collective rituals and occasions of pastoral address, but they also contained within them a kind of theological discourse that was understood to be more than local, universal in theory and in practice linked to wider networks of theological reading. This meant that the theological discourse of the Reformed churches was in a way embedded in pastoral address. In the 19th century, theology and preaching came to be much more differentiated. It also meant that people had complex ways of, the differentiation between theological discourse and preaching ritual has important consequences for what we now call lived religion, which is in fact the kind of religion that is at maximal distance from theological justification. That space opens up tremendously with evangelicalism. But in the earlier period, people had complex ways of distinguishing the sermon text from the preaching occasion. Doctrinal sermon series sometimes required multiple preaching units, as the editors of these series now call them, for what became, in the codex format, one sermon. When the preachers wanted a wide audience, in other words, the application section seemed gratuitous, like clutter. The idea of the sermon could encompass the full dimension of pastoral address, or it could refer to the circulating common discourse of theology, but it could not easily do both. Whether they took notes or not, churchgoers were, for their part, routinely advised to hear in a special way. There is little scholarship on the audition culture of sermon going, though preachers themselves wrote copiously on the topic. Preachers who wrote on this topic include, well, you saw the Whitfield example, but Shepherd, Mayhew, and others all gave sermons on how to hear sermons. I do know of some younger scholars who are doing some work on this. One named Meredith Newman has a book forthcoming on the culture of sermon circulation in New England that has a chapter on shorthand notation that I'm eagerly anticipating. But the consistent themes of all this discourse on how to hear sermons are a rigorous demand of personal, private hearing with no attention to those gathered in the meeting house, and an application of the words of the preacher to oneself as though addressed by God to one's soul. To some degree, this idea of sermon audition as the repression of any awareness of co-present auditors is preacherly ideology, but it is also built into the spatialization, architecture, and facing relationships of preaching before the revivals. A congregation sits collectively but hears privately. This again is something about which I wish there were more scholarship, but I'm just going to do a brief run through some probably to most of you familiar images of churches and preaching situations, just to emphasize the range of possibilities here. This is a 17th century Massachusetts church with pew boxes. Pew boxes do a lot to privatize the situation of audition and to make it easier for you to block out the awareness of the surrounding congregation. This is a Hogarth print of the opposite extreme. An Anglican church in Virginia with the pulpit obviously very sharply set off from the congregation. This is a Lutheran illustration of a Lutheran congregation in 1800 in Pennsylvania. Again, with the full collective life of the community shown and collective witnessing seen as being the main point of the ritual. In fact, it's a little bit hard to pick out the preacher because you're so distracted by things like the dog being chased out by the sexton and so on. But the Reformed tradition is about repressing this kind of awareness of the collective ritual in favor of this kind of vertical facing relationship and a sharply privatizing sense of audition. Oh, I'll go back. I'll get to that in a moment. The text doctrine application form of the Puritan sermon, like the outline form of eighthlies and twelfthlies, also enabled this congregational note-taking, just as it enabled memorization. With the congregation, as with the preacher himself, sermon going often involved both inscription and a special kind of hearing. This has a long tradition, and it's transatlantic. Comenius noted during his visit in England in the early 1640s that a large number of the men and youth copy out sermons with their pens, and this practice clearly carried over to the colonies. As George Solomon long ago observed, if the taking of copious notes had not been part of the New England way, works by many pastors would never have been published. Examples from the 18th century include sermons by the Mathers, Thomas Allen, and Thomas Foxcroft. But evidence of this practice of sermon notation declines sharply after the first quarter of the 18th century, and it would be very interesting to know whether that decline correlates with the rise of evangelicalism. Again, this, as with many cultural formations, the decline is more interesting than the rise, and always less studied. A brief digression might be worthwhile here to remind us that a very different circulatory matrix was in place in the Metropolitan Center of London. New England and the other colonial regions were each unusual, but it is also true that the London example was known across the Atlantic, where it was a source of some anxiety. In London, sermon publication was a competitive trade of capital risk and had been for a long time. Sermon piracy was a frequent enough occurrence for preachers to be worried about it. And one consequence was a leisure public of printed sermons for private reading that could be imagined not just as devotional, but as comparative and thus as aesthetical and critical. Sermons like plays, some please us at the ear, but never will a serious reading bear. Some in the closet edify enough that from the pulpit seemed but sorry stuff. So writes Robert Dodsley, the footman turned poet and playwright in The Art of Preaching in Imitation of Horace's Poetry. Dodsley's title gives us the idea of comparative evaluations of sermons with a pedigree in pagan poetics of all things, imitating Horace. At the time of this poem's appearance in 1738, Dodsley had just used the gains from his successful play, The Toy Shop, to capitalize his venture into bookselling and publishing. He later brought out Akenside, Collins, Gray, and many of the other most distinguished 18th century poets. So it is not entirely surprising that his critical project rests on the circulation of vendable printed sermons. Morals please some and others points of faith, but he's the man, he's the admired divine in whose discourses truth and virtue join. These are the sermons which will ever live. By these our Tonsons and our Naptons thrive. Tonson and Napton were both leading publishers in London. How such are read and praised and how they sell, let Barrows, Clarks, and Butler's sermons tell. So in Dodsley's poem, sermons have become the objects of sale, criticism, and canonization all at once by a condensation that goes without comment in the literary marketplace of London in the 1730s. Dodsley associates the possibility of critical appreciation, particularly with the printed sermon, but not exclusively so. Audition, too, is criticism where there is mobility. For should your manner differ from your theme, or on quite different subjects be the same, despised and laughed at, you must travel down and hide such talents in some country town. The implication, for which there is ample evidence, is that churchgoers, given the close proximity of different churches in London, compared preachers and rated them. Those who could not keep their attention were in effect forced to the provinces where parishioners presumably had no choice. To understand the conventions by which the sermon is imagined as a literary text then, we would need to look beyond the distinction between written text and spoken delivery, inquiring instead into the place of sermons in the book trade, the cultural geography of parish, city, and crowd, Anglican ecclesiology, etc. London was at this point an unusual place to hear sermons. Preachers hoping to preferment hopped about from pulpit to pulpit, and Londoners, therefore, in marked contrast to colonists and provincials, could regularly hear sermons by preachers with whom they had no ongoing relationship. I think that's the key point here. Franklin tells us that he practiced this kind of circulating audition of preachers when he was in London in the 1720s. And what I've so far not mentioned about the Dodsley poem is that, saturated as it seems to be with the special attitudes of an Anglican print culture in London, it was also printed in the colonies at the very outset of the revivals by none other than Benjamin Franklin. In fact, he issued the poem three times, in 1739 and again in 1741 as standalone pamphlets, and again in 1744 in the American Magazine. Franklin in these years was working the revivals for everything they were worth. He had befriended Whitfield and Tennant, publishing Whitfield in numerous editions, and in fact printed on both sides of the controversies as long as they lasted. So if anyone had an interest in promoting a genericized conception of sermons as textual commodities, it was Benjamin Franklin. Franklin's decision to publish this Dodsley poem at this juncture was an intervention in the preaching disputes. It reflects both his experience with urban audition and his assimilation of the new norms of the public sphere, already strongly suggested by his polemical investment in an earlier controversy, the Hemphill affair, about which I'll talk on Wednesday. There were, by Franklin's day, widely differing ways of treating sermons as texts apart from their preaching. One of the most prestigious examples is the work entitled certain sermons, but also known as the Book of Homilies, first disseminated to the English churches in 1547 and repeatedly issued thereafter with some significant changes. In one way, they look quite familiar, printed texts with titles and a table of contents and other marks of clear segmentation and replicability. But in other ways, these are very strange. They name no author, though Cranmer is thought to have a large role in the first version. The text changed substantially without comment in later editions. And the publication in print is oriented not to private silent reading, but to repeated public enunciation by the preachers of the realm. Originality is quite the opposite of the point. The sermons were mandated to be read and reread in cycles and were issued in connection with official efforts to license preachers. Thus, the standardization, dissemination, and replication of the texts allowed the gap between the unnamed author and the multiple dispersed animators of the text. Sorry, this animator is a technical term drawn from Goffman, but in this case, the preachers of the text, to be understood as a sign of authority. The second of the four versions that I've illustrated here, as is the upper right, is Elizabethan and carries a preface explaining that such centralization was needful because all they which are appointed ministers have not the gift of preaching sufficiently to instruct the people. Solomon Stoddard had this text in mind in his 1723 sermon, The Defects of Preachers Reproved, in which he denounces the reading of sermons. I'm quoting Stoddard here. It was ordered in England in the days of King Edward VI that ministers should read printed homilies in public. This is what he's got in mind. And there was a great necessity of it, for there was not one in 10 that were able to make sermons. Obviously, he thinks of sermons as a written text. But it has been the manner of worthy men both here and in other places to deliver their sermons without notes. Note that originality is not Stoddard's main concern. Neither is spontaneity. This is often misrepresented, Stoddard's preference for delivery without notes. It's not about extemporaneous preaching. Originality is not Stoddard's main concern, though it is certainly significant that printed sermons became, after the Elizabethan period, the most consistently authorized of all forms of publication. In an age that is otherwise marked by anonymous and pseudonymous writing, there is no such thing as an anonymous sermon. Again, something that I think is not very well factored into our histories of authorship and intellectual property. Be that as it may, the oralization of a prescripted text evidently means something very different for Stoddard than it did for those who produced and reproduced the Book of Homilies. Like almost all the New England and Middle Colony preachers of the colonial period, Stoddard invokes a spiritistic conception of the preacher's speech that does not preclude the use of script. Indeed, preachers in this tradition are equally distrustful of extemporary improvisation, but understands the difference between the inscribing author and the performing speaker as indicating, ideally, a more than human animation of the word. Sermons when read, this is Stoddard, sermons when read are not delivered with authority and in an affecting way. It is far more profitable to preach in the demonstration of the spirit than with the enticing words of man's wisdom. Stoddard's argument is not new. Since the late 16th century, there had been a tradition of Reformed complaints about read sermons, answered by defenses in which that complaint was routinely misrecognized. In 1683, for example, Bishop Patrick had answered what he thought to be the dissenting complaint about reading sermons, but he took the dissenters to be desiring a more emphatic and entertaining enunciation. But Stoddard's later language is to the point here. What was demanded was not the enticing words of man's wisdom, but preaching in the demonstration of the Spirit. Well, what does that mean? A personally exigent submission of the preacher to his speech, which precedes and inhabits him superpersonally. This is why Whitfield publicly declared that Tillotson, the iconic figure of the literary sermon, a man who is very easy to read as emphatic and entertaining, had no more knowledge of saving grace than Muhammad. Cotton Mather spells out the process of sermon making in his Manuductio ad Ministerium in a way that emphasizes this split between the preacher as auditor and the preacher as animator of his own speech, with the gap between these being spiritistically conceived. After recommending a long shelf of reference works, such as the commonplace book to the Holy Bible and the Bibliotheca Sacra, he describes the process of oralization this way. And when you have dispatched a paragraph of a sermon, I wish it might be a frequent practice with you to make a pause upon it and get your sermon by heart. I mean, get your heart suitably touched with what you have prepared before you go any further, and cast into the mold of the sanctifying truths by such confessions and such petitions as you may dart up to heaven upon them. And least let this be done in your perusing of your whole sermon before your preaching of it. Some celebrated preachers have piously declared that they never durst preach a sermon to others till they have got some good of it by themselves. To feel what you speak, how wondrously will it qualify you to be a lively speaker. Now, it bears emphasizing, given the vogue of the concept of orality, that this idea of the preacher as a lively speaker is entirely enabled by script. And this complex footing is exactly the opposite of an expressive identity. Authoritative speech is that in which the preacher is himself submissive to the Spirit. In the Puritan tradition, this has partly to do with the scripting and memorization process, partly with local turns of rhetoric, partly with the Sabbatarian rhythms and ritual staging of the performance. Established preachers in England, by contrast, had mostly shifted over to an essayistic form in the Restoration, and they did so amid a culture that understood preaching as an essentially persuasive art. It was a relatively small leap for Dodsley, and before him for Addison, to treat Tillotson as a literary composer whose sermons could be read in privacy and evaluated in relation to, say, Atterbury's. To perform the same operation in the case of colonial American preaching requires a much more radical recontextualization. The colonies in this regard were more like the British provinces than like London. Neither the material nor the ideological conditions presupposed by Dodsley obtained there. And there are many reasons for this, which I won't go into in detail. For one thing, preachers in the northern mainland colonies had incredibly long tenures in their pulpits. Most of them were appointed for life and indeed stayed there. There was no such thing as a lectureship in the colonies comparable to the English lectureships that sponsored a lot of Puritan preaching. Federal theology has its own preference for local and pastoralism and so on. As several historians have observed, the whole relation of the preaching situation was conceptualized with a density of ethical address that militated against the possibility of preaching to strangers, at least until the revivals in the late 1730s, when the Reformed tradition suddenly found itself destabilized on this score. From Scotland to Georgia to St. Thomas, and it's very interesting that it's a circumatlantic, almost transperipheral phenomenon, passionate disputes arose as to who was authorized to preach, where, and in what relationship the preacher stood to both his language and to his audience. How should this audience be composed in physical and institutional space? How should one hear or read, with what effect and with what kind of response? How often and with what awareness of preaching elsewhere? It is no exaggeration to say that during the revivals, from the late 1730s through the mid-1740s, one of the principal subjects of evangelical preaching was preaching itself. And that's the New England bracket. Of course, this whole process is repeated constantly in the other colonies at different intervals. These disputes, which are explicit, tell us a lot about the implicit operations of footing in preaching and sermon audition. Now, the main scandals, as is well known, were lay exhorting, the doctrine of inner assurance, and itinerancy. This is Whitfield's portable pulpit, which shows us that itinerancy is not a spontaneous event. In fact, requires furniture. Itinerant preaching involves a changed conception of the event of preaching. Sermonizing is no longer automatically embedded in a pre-existing and ongoing relationship of pastoral care, sanctified by ordination and call, binding preacher and laity into a highly structured ritual event. It could now be spontaneously organized among strangers in a collectivity existing only for the purpose of that event and having no other existence, justified by nothing other than itself. When John Wesley said, "I look upon all the world as my parish," he gave the evangelical rationale both for publication and itinerancy. although he did much more of the former than of the latter, it is easy to forget how disturbing these practices were and what a labor of justification they required. Here, some caricatures or popular illustrations of Whitfield showing, and all these pictures emphasize the same thing, which is the promiscuous and unbounded assembly of hearers who seem to have been called together by no structure or no previous occasion. This is a hostile caricature, obviously, and here's another one. Woman in the foreground is saying, "I wish his spirit were in my flesh." This is an early 19th century illustration. Here's one from the 1830s. Also from the 1830s, this is Philadelphia, which shows you, this is of course the subject I'm going to come to Thursday, is that the new conception of preaching also licensed public speech in lots of ways that weren't anticipated. Popular illustration of Lorenzo Dow from the 1840s. Again, you see the kind of assembly of hearers that is called into being purely by the situation and not by ritual occasion or formal architecture. The prophetic and conversionistic address to strangers outside of the embedding framework of ongoing pastoral relationship constitutes its audience ad hoc, and in so doing seems to imply a theology of conversion that is Arminian, if not liberal. Oh, and this, by the way, there's a circuit rider in a popular mid-19th century iconography. And this is the American Tract Society's illustration of its own procedures, which shows the same kind of sense of how to find a public, that is, you go out and find it. Conversion in this culture is held to be exigent, but not scarce. It is no more restrictive than the potential auditory. As the religious historian Sidney Mead put it half a century ago, the revivalist gravitates almost inevitably toward the idea that whosoever will may come, and this tendency, coupled with the necessarily concomitant stress on personal religious experience in conversion, tends to make man's initiative primary. Revivalism thus tends to lean theologically in an Arminian or even Pelagian direction, with the implicit suggestion that man saves himself through choice. By the early 19th century, revivalism itself had ensured the triumph of the very theology that Edwards despised most. The cautious psychology of conversion developed by New England Puritanism had given way to a new hierarchy of faculties in which people were imagined as freely choosing their own salvation, somewhat as one assents to a proposition, although there are differences, which I'll talk about Wednesday. God himself came to be reconceived according to the structural demands of this form of preaching as a rhetorical God addressing himself to potential converts with impressive incentives for belief in his existence. A second related irony is that the organization of revivalist preaching helped instantiate a social imaginary of denominationalism. Churches oriented themselves less to stable local populations that could theoretically be encompassed under a single congregation for life, saturating the local public space of intellectual and moral authority, and began instead to orient themselves to transitory movements of strangers who would attach themselves to the congregation as the form of voluntary association. This is what the Protestant churches of mid-19th century America never tired of reminding people about themselves, is that they were the exemplification of the voluntary principle. The aspiration to the national church in this framework was abandoned, partly because the new conception enabled such a powerful prophetic solicitation of converts, but it was contradictory. The church-going public was construed simultaneously as a Christian nation and as the unredeemed mass from which converts must be called. To some degree, this is, of course, a long-standing tension in Protestant preaching, but in the new system, it became everywhere repeated on the surface. We might even say that in addressing a world of strangers prophetically, evangelical preaching helped to produce the field of the secular that was committed to a Christian nationalism in which that field must be denied. Thank you.
take a couple, oh, time for a couple
as
questions?
As many as people have, or as many as you'll let me take.
Sure. Thanks, Andrew. That was a really fascinating talk, and it certainly makes me, it puts in a new context a lot of what I think about sermons of earlier. So I was wondering if I could get you to comment on it. It struck me, there's a couple things that struck me. One you sort of touched on, but I was hoping you might say more. One is that sermons in the late 16th, early 17th century are popular, they are printed, they're probably about 9% of the speculative book trade, they sell fairly well, and we don't have the kind of business documents that you have, but there's certainly nothing about them that suggests they're largely subsidized.
Uh-huh.
And they look like speculative production. And you mentioned that was true of London later. And therefore they are largely addressed to the anonymous reading public, though they do mention parishes, like the Kidderminster, for example.
Yeah.
But they're not evangelical. They're perfectly orthodox, most of them.
Yeah.
They're at least nominally Calvinist and anti-Pelagian.
Right.
So one question I have is, how do we get from there to the situation, to the normative situation you described in early America, that then the evangelical movement has to kind of reinvent parts of while rejecting other parts of it? So that the second distinction that's more off the topic but struck me, and now I'm thinking might be related, is about collecting, because you said that at least in the pre-evangelical period there's not a lot of sermon collection, but one of the really distinctive things about sermons in the late 16th and early 17th century in London is they're constantly being collected. I mean, they're hugely collectible. They're put in, the same sermon will appear in five different configurations of different sermon collections by a certain author, five sermons by the Perkins, 12 sermons by Perkins, right? So it struck me that there's something interesting going on there, and I don't know whether it's temporal or whether it's metropole versus colony.
Well, there are other people in the room who could answer this question probably a lot better than I can, but one limitation against printing collections of a particular preacher's sermons is the limitation that exists against printing anything lengthy in the colonies, which is that no printer had the capital to invest in that paper stock. So there aren't collections of anybody on any, there's nothing along. However, most of these printers had transatlantic connections, and so those who published sermons beyond any length tended to publish them in London. But even that, it just does seem to me to suggest sharply different cultures of preaching as well as different cultures of printing. And some of this, I think, is accounted for by that Federalist theological tradition that gets so well developed in 17th century New England. But your other question about how we get from this world in which London has a really market-driven culture of sermon audition, and so develops the idea of a literary sermon, and so shifts over to an essayistic form of sermon in the latitudinarian tradition, which encompasses both Anglicans and nonconformists in its reading audience, contrasted with the colonial situation in which you have almost no speculative market-driven publication and very little translocal circulation and a strongly pastoral conception of the ritual occasion. How we get from either of those to the situation we find at the end of the 18th century of this normatively expansive conversionistic address is to me something of a mystery. On both sides of the Atlantic, it's a bit of a puzzle, because obviously as you yourself mentioned that in the 17th century most of these are squarely Calvinist Anglican publications. It doesn't, the fact of a market-driven sermon culture does not mean that you're inevitably going to get evangelicalism, but neither does affective pietism. What's required for evangelicalism is this new conception of the social and a new set of spatial practices that emphasize mobility and contact with strangers, and that has to become normatively animated somehow for people to begin thinking that it's not only a scandal to preach to people that you're not in an ordained relationship with, it's a desirable good. Well, how did that normative shift change? And I think it happens not strictly by theological transformations and not strictly by these market practices, but by this new configuration that comes about in the 18th century between market practices, rhetorics of news and contemporaneity and this new conception of the social as being what I'm relying on here is what Charles Taylor calls a modern social imaginary. That is the idea that the social is an aggregation of private people acting for mutual benefit. And I think once you've got that in place, it's easier to see these sermons in that context. Yeah.
Well, I was just wondering whether you look at other forms of print or other print venues that go along with the printing of sermons or maybe the not printing of sermons. So that in the 1730s and 40s, there's a lot of newspaper discussion and indeed pamphlet discussion about sermons that were preached and caused a variety of political and economic kind of blow-ups. And so here you have a discussion. It's almost as if the application is in another format than in the printed sermon. You get these discussions in newspapers about what we're supposed to take away from the sermon that he gave was it's about servants not turning away from their masters and wives not turning away from their husbands.
Yes, exactly.
There's all this application that happens outside the publication.
Well, that's beautifully put. Thank you so much. That's that states very elegantly one of the topics that's going to come up on Wednesday. I mentioned it briefly today in saying that the sermons that are speculatively published and get this big audience are the ones that come closest to news. In fact, there's a lot of bleed over between news and sermon publication, especially at that height of the revival controversies. And I think that process is, as much as anything, what transforms the conception of preaching. Yeah. David.
One of the, just to get what was said behind me here, one of the complications of any rich narrative of your kind is chronology, or chronologies, we might say, so that it's very, very tempting among Americans to pick Whitfield. Actually, there's that explosion in print doesn't persist.
That's right. That's right. It drops off during the war.
It's a tiny lift, actually, in the overall curve. And later on, revivals revert to much smaller scale thing. Stephen Marini has said this, and they're just very, very local, they're very, very small.
Right.
And they're not publicized very widely. It's not until the 90s that, again, the second half of the 90s, that the collective publicity is, which is also actually initially regional rather than national or transnational. And then you get to King Ridge of 1801.
Yeah.
And many, there is some signs that actually is publicized in a way that. And then that leads on to the huge publicity of defending and so forth and so on. So that it's there's no solution to the matter of chronology. But even evangelicalism, as you evoked it in your table of characteristics, we might say it's really 19th century rather than 18th. So you have the pre-partially evangelical, further. It's just impossible.
That's right. No,
these days, but the privilege Whitfield is a problem.
Yeah.
The problem that Stout didn't recognize in that argument, which where he shows really elite culture collapsing into democratic culture. Of course, he didn't do that.
So right. Right.
Elite culture, which is Becky didn't interrogate the category of elite culture. It's complicated. All the things you've made are terrific points. They do bob around a little bit chronologically, which, believe me,
yeah, no, they do. And in fact, I think that this point has been made powerfully by John Butler in that classic essay in which he essentially deconstructed the idea of the Great Awakening. And this is one reason why I never said the phrase the Great Awakening, is that he shows that what we usually think of as a set of local, contained, or regional events happens in the late 1730s and 40s in New England, happens in 1760s in Virginia. It keeps happening around. And so one thing one might say is that, well, once revivalism gets this generic form, it's available to happen in a variety of places. And of course, the form takes on it gets refined in the 19th century. And it's a long process. I don't mean to be telling the kind of story in which we suddenly shift over entirely from one mode to the other. It's very important to recognize that this evangelical mode is in sharp competition, not primarily with secular humanism, which is now the myth that evangelicalism is telling itself, but with other forms of religiosity. And I think the struggle over what religiosity is what needs to be at the foreground. It's a very, very long and complicated process. Whitfield is a useful fulcrum for me just because my four case studies all have something to do with him. But and Marant is later and is southern, and you know, we'll pick up on some of the differences. But David's point is an excellent one, which is you can't tell a story of, you know, there was no evangelicalism and then there was evangelicalism. Even post Whitfield, when people begin to develop the norms that I'm singling out as of special interest to me because I'm interested in the discourse culture, the norms that I'm singling out of itinerancy, conversionistic address to strangers, and so on, do I think appear in a much more explicit and volatile way. They're the explicit subjects of controversy and conflict in the 1740s. And from that point, especially as they get picked up in public sphere environments like newspapers and pamphlets and controversial wars, they gradually get genericized. So all I mean to be saying is that that's where I think the motor energy is in this conception of how to address a public and how to constitute religious speech. Do you have a follow-up? Peter.
I wanted to go back actually to Zach's point, because I mean Zach's done wonderful work on this, the actual sort of figures of sermons and so on, it's certainly true. But I wonder about that, about how market driven it is, because what really strikes me about the London book trade is how much it is not market driven. In other words, a huge range, so more like the system that you're developing. And you know, just two areas in which you see this is just the immense significance that remains of patronage, where people actually, the one person who draws up figures for this in the early 17th century, some not very major writer, but he draws up these figures. It's clearly patronage is far more important to him than anything on the market. And so it's far more local from that point of view. And the second thing is that, by and large, authors are not being paid in England during the 17th century. They're paid in books. Yeah. And a typical payment is 12 books or 25 books, something like that. And there's been this gross exaggeration of the very, very few people who are paid. And that if you actually look at it, the people who normally get paid are almanac compilers, people like this. But really, most people are not getting paid. And why they get books is because they then use them for patronage. They actually distribute them to people, they give them as gifts, you know, around. You know, this whole gift system, which remains immensely important and often very localist, so much more like the one we're looking at. And it is true that on the other hand, the extreme opposite, and there's no one like it, is Tillotson. And Tillotson's works are sold by Widow for £2,000.
Right.
I don't know anyone who got anything like £2,000. Anyone else. You know, people use Milton as if, but Milton's trivial.
But he'd been unusual from the beginning of his career. His early sermons were printed and reprinted as standalone pamphlets. You see nothing like that in the colonies. I think the only sermon I know of that was reprinted more than once, I haven't checked this, you know, I don't trust this. The only one I can think of that was printed more than once as a standalone pamphlet was Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, which went through 6 editions in the 18th century. It's very unusual for anything to happen to that, but Tillotson was doing that from the beginning.
But that's exactly what Zach shows for sermons earlier, that you know, you've got this tiny little group of sermons which get massively reprinted and give this impression of a market model in sermons. But sermons, as Zach's figure shows, actually less reprinted statistically than plays. You know, so it's, am I right? Am I putting it correctly? Yeah.
Interesting.
Exactly. So there are many more of them, but there's still many of these are very local, it seems to me.
But it's not that, but there certainly are sermons. Henry Smith, you know,
Henry Smith is the one who's pirated.
There's a small minority of all sermons, but it's not that uncommon for sermons. I mean, about 20% of sermons that are standalone are reprinted at least once.
Really?
So
okay.
That's a very different situation still, it seems to me.
Right.
Can we do one more and before the caterers leave us? Take your food back with us.
Yes.
This might be pushing you a little bit into the 19th century, but I was wondering if you think that the literacy of the North, which was enabled by the literacy factories of the Sunday schools created by Horace Mann and Seward and Beecher and Stowe, created a difference in the possibility of a public sphere in the North, as opposed to the demonic, non-literary sermons of the South?
I don't know. I my instinct is to resist that somewhat. That's not...
The chronology doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think I've made it clear that I don't believe in orality at all, but I don't think it's generalizable as a democratic force by any means. But this is another conversation. We certainly have to talk about, if we're talking about the 19th century world of evangelicalism, which David thinks I'm already talking too much about, but we would have to talk about the way the evangelical idea of the diffusion of science and religion motivates those literacy machines, and is their ideology. But whether it can be, whether literacy or it can be appealed to as an explanatory device, I'm very skeptical. I think literacy is probably more an ideological concept than a useful interpretive tool.
Well, thank you, Michael, very much.
I thought that was a power button.
We can carry the conversation on over food and drink in the Furness Library. Mm-hmm.